of prime importance to Fannie Mae, but only after it discovered its hedgehog concept and after it reached breakthrough. Technology was a key part of what Fannie Mae leaders called the second wind of the transformation and acted as an accelerating factor. The same pattern holds for Kroger, Gillette, Walgreens, in fact, all the good to great companies. The pioneering application of technology came late in the transition and never at the start. We get now to the punchline of this chapter. When used right, technology becomes an accelerator of momentum, not a creator of momentum. The good to great companies never began their transitions with pioneering technology, for the simple reason that you cannot make good use of technology until you know which technologies are relevant. And which are those? Those and only those that link directly to the three intersecting circles of the hedgehog concept. To make technology productive in a transformation from good to great means asking the following questions. Does the technology fit directly with your hedgehog concept? If yes, then you need to become a pioneer in the application of that technology. If no, then ask, do you need this technology at all? If you need the technology at a base level, then all you need is parity. You don't necessarily need the world's most advanced phone system to be a great company. If the technology is irrelevant, then you can ignore it. We came to see the pioneering application of technology as just one more way in which the good to great companies remained disciplined within the frame of their hedgehog concept. Conceptually, their relationship to technology is no different from their relationship to any other category of decisions. Disciplined people who engage in disciplined thought and who then take disciplined action. If a technology doesn't fit squarely within the three circles, they ignore all the hype and fear and just go about their business with a remarkable degree of equanimity. However, once they understand which technologies are relevant, which technologies fit with the hedgehog, which technologies tie to the three circles, they became fanatical and creative in the application of those specific technologies. In the comparison companies, by contrast, we found only three cases of pioneering in the application of technology. Those three cases, Chrysler, Harris, and Rubbermaid, were all unsustained comparisons, which demonstrates that technology alone cannot create sustained great results. Chrysler, for instance, made superb use of advanced computer-aided and other design technologies, but it failed to link those technologies to a consistent hedgehog concept. As Chrysler strayed outside the three circles in the mid-1980s, from Gulfstream jets to Italian sports cars, no advanced technology by itself could save the company from another massive downturn. Technology without a clear hedgehog concept and without the discipline to stay in the three circles cannot make a company great. Two incidents stood out in my mind as I wrote this chapter. The first is Time Magazine's selection in 1999 of Albert Einstein as Person of the 20th Century. If you frame the Person of the Century selection around the question, how different would the world be today if that person had not existed? The choice of Einstein is perhaps surprising, compared to leaders like Churchill, Hitler, Stalin, and Gandhi. People who truly changed the course of human history, for better or worse. Physicists point out that the scientific community would have reached an understanding of relativity with or without Einstein. Perhaps 5 years later, certainly 10, but not 50. The Nazis never got the bomb, and the Allies would have won the Second World War without it, although it would have cost more Allied lives. So why did Time pick Einstein? In explaining their selection, Time editors wrote, "It's hard to compare the influence of statesmen with that of scientists. Nevertheless, we can note that there are certain eras that were most defined by their politics, others by their culture, and others by their scientific advances. So how will the 20th century be remembered? Yes for democracy, and yes for civil rights, but the 20th century will be most remembered for its earth-shaking advances in science and technology, which advanced the cause of freedom in some ways more than any statesman did. In a century that will be remembered foremost for its science and technology, one person stands out as the paramount icon of our age, Albert Einstein. The Time editors didn't pick the person of the century so much as they picked the theme of the century, technology and science, and attached the most famous person to it. Interestingly, just a few days before the Einstein announcement, Time announced its person of the year for 1999. Who did it pick? None other than the poster child of e-commerce, Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, reflecting yet again our cultural obsession with technology-driven change. Let me be clear. I neither agree nor disagree with Time's choices. I simply find them interesting and illuminating because they give us a window into our modern psyche. Clearly, a key item on our collective mind is technology and its implication. Which brings me to a second incident. Taking a short break from the rigors of writing this book, I traveled to Minnesota to teach sessions at the Masters Forum. The Masters Forum has held executive seminars for nearly 15 years. I was curious to know which themes appeared repeatedly over those years. One of the consistent themes, said Jim Erickson and Patty Griffin Jensen, program directors, is technology, change, and the connection between the two. Why do you suppose that is? I asked. People don't know what they don't know, they said, and they're always afraid that some new technology is going to sneak up on them from behind, knock them on the head. They don't understand technology, and many fear it. All they know for sure is that technology is an important force, and that they'd better pay attention to it. Given our culture's obsession with technology, and given the pioneering application of technology in the good to great companies, you might expect that technology would absorb a significant portion of the discussion in our interviews with the good to great executives. Well, you might expect that, and we did, but we were quite surprised to find the opposite. Fully 80% of the good to great executives we interviewed didn't even mention technology as one of the top five factors in the transition. Furthermore, in the cases where they did mention technology, it had a median ranking of 4th out of 5, with only 2 executives of 84 people we interviewed ranking at number 1. If technology is so vitally important, why did the good to great executives talk so little about it? Certainly not because they ignored technology. They were technologically sophisticated and, in fact, vastly superior to their comparisons. Furthermore, a number of the good to great companies received extensive media coverage and awards for their pioneering use of technology. Yet the executives themselves hardly talked about technology. It's as if the media articles and the executives were discussing 2 totally different sets of companies. Nucor, for example, became widely known as one of the most aggressive pioneers in the application of mini-mill steel manufacturing, with dozens of articles and 2 books that celebrated its bold investments in continuous thin-slab casting and electric arc furnaces. Nucor became a cornerstone case at business schools as an example of unseating the old order through the advanced application of new technologies. But when we asked Ken Iverson, CEO of Nucor, during its transition to name the top 5 factors in the shift from good to great, where on the list do you think he put technology? First? Nope. Second? Nope. Third? Nope. Fourth? Not even. Fifth? Sorry, but no. The primary factors, said Ken Iverson, were the consistency of the company and our ability to project its philosophies throughout the whole organization, enabled by our lack of layers and bureaucracy. Stop and think about this for a minute. Here we have a consummate case study of upending the old order with new technology. That's what Nucor was known for. It's what it was taught about in business schools. And yet the chief executive, who made it happen, doesn't even list technology in the top five factors in the shift from good to great. The same pattern continued throughout the Nucor interviews. Of the seven key executives and board members we interviewed, only one picked technology as the number one factor in the shift, and most focused on other factors. A few executives did talk about Nucor's big bets on technology somewhere in the interview, but they emphasized other factors even more. Getting people with that farmer work ethic on the bus, getting the right people in key management positions, the simple structure, lack of bureaucracy, the relentless performance culture that increases profit per ton of finished steel. Technology was part of the Nucor equation, but a secondary part. One Nucor executive summed up, 20% of our business is the new technology that we embrace, but 80% of our success is in the culture of our company. You could have given the exact same technology at the exact same time to any number of companies with the exact same resources as Nucor, and even still, they would have failed to deliver Nucor's results. Like the Daytona 500, the primary variable in winning is not the car, but the driver and his team. Not that the car is unimportant, but the car is secondary. Mediocrity results first and foremost from management failure, not technological failure. Bethlehem Steel's difficulties had less to do with the mini mill technology and more to do with its history of adversarial labor relations, which ultimately had its roots in unenlightened and ineffective management. Bethlehem had already begun its long slide before Nucor and the other mini mills had taken significant market share. In fact, by the time Nucor made its technological breakthrough with continuous thin slab casting in 1986, Bethlehem had already lost more than 80% of its value relative to the market. This is not to say that technology played no role in Bethlehem's demise. Technology did play a role, and ultimately a significant one. But technology's role was as an accelerator of Bethlehem's demise, not the cause. Again, it's the same principle at work. Technology as an accelerator, not a cause. Only in this comparison case, the principle operates in reverse. When we examined the comparison companies, we did not find a single example of a comparison company's demise coming primarily from a technology torpedo that blew it out of the water. Not one. R.J. Reynolds lost its position as the number one tobacco company in the world, not because of technology, but because RJR management thrashed about with undisciplined diversification and later went on a let's make management rich at the expense of the company buyout binge. A&P fell from the second largest company in America to irrelevance. Not because it lagged behind Kroger in scanning technology, but because it lacked the discipline to confront the brutal facts of reality about the changing nature of grocery stores. The evidence from our study does not support the idea that technological change plays the principal role in the decline of once great companies or the perpetual mediocrity of others. Certainly technology is important. You can't remain a laggard and hope to be great. But technology by itself is never a primary cause of either greatness or decline. Throughout business history, early technology pioneers rarely prevail in the end. VisiCalc, for example, was the first major personal computer spreadsheet. Where is VisiCalc today? Do you know anyone who uses it? And what of the company that pioneered it? Gone. Doesn't even exist. VisiCalc eventually lost out to Lotus 1-2-3, which itself lost out to Excel. Lotus then went into a tailspin, saved only by selling out to IBM. The first portable computers came from now-dead companies such as Osborne Computers. Today, we primarily use portables from companies such as Dell and Sony. This pattern of the second or third or fourth follower prevailing over the early trailblazers shows up through the entire history of technological and economic change. IBM did not have the early lead in computers. It lagged so far behind Remington Rand, which had the UNIVAC, the first commercially successful large-scale computer, that people called IBM's first computer IBM's UNIVAC. Boeing did not pioneer the commercial jet. De Havilland did, with the Comet, but lost ground when one of its early jets exploded in midair. Not exactly a good brand-building moment. Boeing, slower to market, invested in making the safest, most reliable jets and dominated the airways for over three decades. I could go on for pages. GE did not pioneer the AC electrical system. Westinghouse did. Palm Computing did not pioneer the personal digital assistant. Apple did, with its high-profile Newton. AOL did not pioneer the consumer internet community. CompuServe, Prodigy, they did. We could make a long list of companies that were technology leaders, but that failed to prevail in the end as great companies. It would be a fascinating list in itself, but all the examples would underscore a basic truth. Technology cannot turn a good company into a great one, nor by itself prevent disaster. History teaches this lesson repeatedly. Consider the United States debacle in Vietnam. The United States had the most technologically advanced fighting force the world has ever known. Super fighter jets, helicopter gunships, advanced weapons, computers, sophisticated communications, miles of high-tech border sensors. Indeed, the reliance on technology created a false sense of invulnerability. The Americans lacked not technology, but a simple and coherent concept for the war, on which to attach that technology. It lurched back and forth across a variety of ineffective strategies, never getting the upper hand. Meanwhile, the technologically inferior North Vietnamese forces adhered to a simple, coherent concept, a guerrilla war of attrition, aimed at methodically wearing down public support for the war at home. What little technology the North Vietnamese did employ, such as the AK-47 rifle, much more reliable and easier to maintain in the field than the complicated M-16, linked directly to that simple concept. And in the end, as you know, the United States, despite all its technological sophistication, did not succeed in Vietnam. If you ever find yourself thinking that technology alone holds the key to success, then think again of Vietnam. Thoughtless reliance on technology is a liability, not an asset. Yes, when used right, when linked to a simple, clear, and coherent concept rooted in deep understanding, technology is an essential driver in accelerating forward momentum. But when used wrong, when grasped as an easy solution without deep understanding of how it links to a clear and coherent concept, technology simply accelerates your own self-created demise. Technology and the fear of being left behind. The research team ferociously debated whether this topic merited its own chapter. There must be a technology chapter, said Scott Jones. We're bombarded by the importance of technology these days at the business school. If we don't address it, we'll leave a huge hole in the book. But it seems to me, countered Brian Larson, that our technology finding is, well, just a special case of disciplined action. It belongs in the previous chapter. Disciplined action means staying within the three circles. That's the essence of the technology finding. True, but it's a very special case, pointed out Scott Cederberg. Every one of the companies became extreme pioneers in the application of technology long before the rest of the world became technology obsessed. I think it needs to be in there. But compared to the other findings like Level 5, the Hedgehog Concept, First 2, Technology just feels like a much smaller issue, responded Amber Young. I agree with Brian. Technology is important, but as a subset of discipline, or perhaps the flywheel, but not a concept on its own. We argued throughout the summer. Then Chris Jones, in her typically quiet and thoughtful way, asked a key question. Why? Why did the good-to-great companies maintain such a balanced perspective on technology, when most companies become reactionary, lurching and running about like Chicken Little, as we're seeing with the internet? Why indeed? Chris's question led us to an essential difference between great companies and good companies, a difference that has ultimately, at least in my mind, tipped the balance of including this chapter. If you had the opportunity to sit down and read all 2,000-plus pages of transcripts from the Good to Great interviews, you'd be struck by the utter absence of talk about competitive strategy. Yes, they did talk about strategy, and they did talk about performance, and they did talk about becoming the best, and they even talked about winning. But they never talked in reactionary terms, and never defined their strategies principally in response to what others were doing. They talked in terms of what they were trying to create and how they were trying to improve relative to an absolute standard of excellence. When we asked George Harvey to describe his motivation for bringing change to Pitney Bowes in the 1980s, he said, "I've always wanted to see Pitney Bowes as a great company. Let's start with that, all right? Let's just start there. That's a given. It needs no justification or explanation. We're not there today. We won't be there tomorrow. There is always so much more to create for greatness in an ever-changing world." Or, as Wayne Sanders summed up about the ethos that came to typify the inner workings of Kimberly-Clark, "We're just never satisfied. We can be delighted, but never satisfied." Those who built the good to great companies weren't motivated by fear. They weren't driven by fear of what they didn't understand. They weren't driven by fear of looking like a chump. They weren't driven by fear of watching others hit it big while they didn't. They weren't driven by the fear of being hammered by the competition. Those who turn good into great are motivated by a deep creative urge and an inner compulsion for sheer, unadulterated excellence for its own sake. Those who build and perpetuate mediocrity, in contrast, are more motivated by fear, the fear of being left behind. Never was there a better example of this difference than during the technology bubble of the late 1990s, which happened to take place right smack in the middle of the research on good to great. It served as an almost perfect stage to watch the difference between great and good play itself out, as the great ones responded like Walgreens, with calm equanimity and quiet, deliberate steps forward. Well, mediocre ones, they lurched about in fearful, frantic, Chicken Little reaction. The big point of this chapter is not about technology per se. No technology, no matter how amazing, not computers, not telecommunications, not robotics, not the internet, can by itself ignite a shift from good to great. No technology can make you level 5. No technology can turn the wrong people into the right people. No technology can instill the discipline to confront the brutal facts. No technology can instill unwavering faith. No technology can supplant the need for deep understanding of the three circles. No technology can drive you to that simple, crystalline understanding of a hedgehog concept. No technology can create a culture of discipline. No technology can instill the simple inner belief that leaving unrealized potential on the table, letting something remain good when it can become great, is a secular sin. Those that stay true to these fundamentals and maintain their balance even in times of great change and disruption will accumulate the momentum that creates breakthrough momentum. Those that do not, those that fall into reactionary lurching about, will spiral downward and remain mediocre. This is the big picture difference between great and good, the gestalt of the whole study, captured in the metaphor of the flywheel versus the doom loop. And it is to that overarching contrast that we will turn in the next chapter. Chapter summary, technology accelerators. The good to great organizations think differently about technology and technological change than mediocre ones. Good to great companies avoid technology fads and bandwagons. Yet, paradoxically, they also become pioneers in the application of carefully selected technology. The key question about any technology is, does the technology fit directly with your hedgehog concept? If yes, then you need to become a pioneer in the application of that technology. If no, then you can settle for parity, or perhaps even ignore it entirely. The good to great companies use technology as an accelerator of momentum, not a creator of momentum. None of the good to great companies began their transformations with pioneering technology, yet they all became pioneers in the application of technology once they grasped how it fit with the three circles and after they'd hit breakthrough. You could have taken the exact same leading-edge technologies pioneered at the good-to-great companies and handed them to the comparison companies for free. Here, have it. You have it. Take it. And the comparison companies still would have failed to produce the same results. How a company reacts to technological change is a good indicator of its inner drive for greatness. Great companies respond with thoughtfulness and creativity, driven by that productive neurosis, a compulsion to turn unrealized potential into results. Mediocre companies react and lurch about, motivated by the fear of being left behind. Some unexpected findings. The whole idea that technological change is the principal cause in the decline of once great companies is simply not supported by the evidence. Certainly a company can't remain a laggard and hope to be great, but technology by itself is never a primary root cause of either greatness or decline. Across 84 interviews with good to great executives, fully 80% didn't even bother to mention technology as one of the top five factors in the transformation. This is true even in companies famous for their pioneering application of technology, such as Nucor. And finally, crawl, walk, run can be a very effective approach, even and perhaps especially during times of rapid and radical technological change. Chapter 8, The Flywheel and the Doom Loop. Revolution means turning the wheel. Igor Stravinsky. Picture a huge heavy flywheel, a massive metal disc mounted horizontally on an axle, about 30 feet in diameter, 2 feet thick and weighing about 5,000 pounds. Now imagine that your task is to get the flywheel rotating on the axle as fast and long as possible. Pushing with great effort, you get the flywheel to inch forward, moving almost imperceptibly at first. You keep pushing, and after 2 or 3 hours of persistent effort, you get the flywheel to complete one entire turn. You keep pushing, and the flywheel begins to move a bit faster, and with continued great effort, you move it around a second rotation. You keep pushing in an intelligent, consistent direction. Three turns, four turns, five, six, the flywheel builds up speed. Seven, eight, you keep pushing. Nine, 10, builds momentum. 11, 12, moving faster with each turn. 20, 30, 50, 100, 1,000. Then, at some point, breakthrough. The momentum of the thing kicks in your favor, hurling the flywheel forward, turn after turn, whoosh, its own heavy weight working for you. You're pushing no harder than during the first rotation, but the flywheel goes faster and faster. Each turn of the flywheel builds upon work done earlier, compounding your investment of effort. 1,000 times faster, then 10,000, then 100,000. The huge, heavy disc flies forward with almost unstoppable momentum. Now, suppose someone came along and asked, "So what was the one big push that caused this thing to go so fast?" You wouldn't be able to answer. It's just a nonsense question. Was it the first push? The second? The fifth? The hundredth? No, it was all of them. All of them added together in an overall accumulation of effort applied in a consistent direction. Sure, some pushes may have been larger than other pushes, but any single heave, no matter how large, reflects a small fraction of the entire cumulative effect on the flywheel. Build up and breakthrough. The flywheel image captures the overall feel of what it was like inside the companies as they went from good to great. No matter how dramatic the end result, the good to great transformations never happened in one fell swoop. There was no single defining action, no grand program, no one killer innovation, no solitary lucky break, no wrenching revolution. Good to great comes about by a cumulative process, step by step, action by action, decision by decision, turn by turn of the flywheel. That adds up to sustained and spectacular results. Yet to read the media accounts of the companies, you might draw an entirely different conclusion. Often the media does not cover a company until the flywheel is already turning at 1,000 RPMs per minute. This entirely skews our perception of how such transformations happen, making it seem as if they jumped right to breakthrough as some sort of an overnight metamorphosis. On August 27, 1984, Forbes magazine published an article on Circuit City. It was the first national-level profile ever published on the company. It wasn't that big of an article, just two pages, and it questioned whether Circuit City's recent growth could continue. Still, there it was, the first public acknowledgement that Circuit City had broken through. The journalist had just identified a hot new company, almost like an overnight success story. This particular overnight success story, however, had been more than a decade in the making. Alan Wurzel had inherited CEO responsibility from his father in 1973, with the firm close to bankruptcy. First, he rebuilt his executive team and undertook an objective look at the brutal facts, both internal and external. In 1974, still struggling with a crushing debt load, Wurzel and his team began to experiment with a warehouse showroom style of retailing, large inventories of name brands, discount pricing, and immediate delivery. And they built a prototype of this model in Richmond, Virginia, to sell appliances. In 1976, the company began to experiment with selling consumer electronics in that warehouse showroom concept. And in 1977, it transformed the concept into the first ever Circuit City store. The concept met with success, and the company began to systematically convert its stereo stores into Circuit City stores. In 1982, with 9 years of accumulated turns on the flywheel, Wurzel and his team committed fully to the concept of the Circuit City Superstore. Over the next 5 years, as it shifted entirely to the concept, Circuit City generated the highest total return to shareholders of any company on the New York Stock Exchange. From 1982 to 1999, Circuit City generated stock returns 22 times better than the market, handily beating Intel, Walmart, GE, Hewlett-Packard, and Coca-Cola. We shouldn't be surprised that Circuit City then found itself a prime subject for media attention. Whereas we found no articles of any significance in the decade leading up to that transition point, we found 97 articles worth examining in the decade after the transition, 22 of them significant pieces. It's as if the company hadn't even existed prior to that, despite having traded on a major stock exchange since 1968, and despite the remarkable progress made by Wurzel and his team in the decade leading up to that breakthrough point. The Circuit City experience reflects a common pattern. In case after case, we found fewer articles in the decade leading up to the point of the transition than in the decade after, by an average factor of nearly 3 times. For example, Ken Iverson and Sam Siegel began turning the Nucor flywheel in 1965. For 10 years, no one paid any attention, certainly not the financial press or even the other steel companies. If you'd asked executives at Bethlehem Steel or U.S. Steel about the Nucor threat in 1970, they would have laughed, if they even recognized the company name, which is doubtful. By 1975, the year of its transition point on the stock chart, Nucor had already built its third mini-mill, long established its culture of productivity, and was well on the way to becoming the most profitable steel company in America. Yet, the first major article in Business Week did not appear until 1978, 13 years after the start of the transition. 13 years! And not in Fortune until 16 years out. From 1965 to 1975, we found only 11 articles on Nucor, none of them significant. Then, from 1976 through 1995, we collected 96 articles on Nucor, 40 of them being major profiles or nationally prominent features. You're probably thinking, but we should expect that. Of course, these companies would get more coverage after they became wildly successful. What's so important about that? Here's what's important. We've allowed the way transitions look from the outside to drive our perception of what they must feel like to those going through them on the inside. From the outside, they look like a dramatic, almost revolutionary breakthrough. But from the inside, they feel completely different, more like an organic development process. Picture an egg just sitting there. No one pays it much attention until one day the egg cracks open and out jumps a chicken. All the major magazines and newspapers jump on the event writing feature stories. Transformation of egg to chicken. Remarkable revolution of the egg. Stunning turnaround at egg. As if the egg had undergone some overnight metamorphosis, radically altering itself into a chicken. But what does it look like from the chicken's point of view? It's a completely different story. While the world ignored this dormant-looking egg, the chicken was evolving, growing, developing, incubating. From the chicken's point of view, cracking the egg is simply one more step in a long chain of steps leading up to that moment. A big step, to be sure, but hardly the radical, single-step transformation it looks like to those watching from outside the egg. You might think it's a silly analogy, but I'm using it to highlight a very important finding from our research. We kept thinking that we'd find the one big thing, the miracle moment that defined breakthrough. We even pushed for it in our interviews. But the good to great executives simply could not pinpoint a single key event or moment in time that exemplified the transition. Sometimes they even chafed against the whole idea of allocating points and prioritizing factors. In every good to great company, at least one of the interviewees gave an unprompted admonishment, saying something along the lines of, "Look, you can't dissect this thing into a series of nice little boxes and factors, or identify the moment of aha, or the one big thing. It was a whole bunch of interlocking pieces that built one upon another. Got it?" Even in the most dramatic case in our study, Kimberly Clark selling the mills, the executives described an organic cumulative process. "Darwin did not change the direction of the company overnight," said one Kimberly executive. "He evolved it over time." "The transition wasn't like night and day," said another. "It was gradual, and I don't think it was entirely clear to everybody until a few years into it. Of course, selling the mills was a gigantic push on the flywheel. But it was only one push. After selling the mills, the full transformation into the number one paper-based consumer products company required thousands of additional pushes on the flywheel, big and small, accumulated one on top of another. It took years to gain enough momentum for the press to openly herald Kimberly-Clark's shift from good to great. Forbes magazine wrote, "When Kimberly-Clark decided to go head-to-head against Procter & Gamble, this magazine predicted disaster. What a dumb idea." As it turns out, it wasn't a dumb idea. It was a smart idea. The amount of time between the two Forbes articles, the one that predicted disaster and the one that said it wasn't a disaster? 21 years. While working on the project, we made a habit of asking executives who visited our research laboratory what they wanted to know from the research. One CEO asked, "What did they call what they were doing? Did they have a name for it? How did they talk about it at the time?" Isn't that a wonderful question? We went back to look. The astounding answer. You want to know what they called it at the time? They didn't call it anything. The good to great companies had no name for their transformations. There was no launch event, no tagline, no programmatic feel whatsoever. Some said they weren't even aware. They weren't even aware that a major transformation was underway until they were well into it. It was at times more obvious to them after the fact than at the time. Then it began to dawn on us. There was no miracle moment. Although it may have looked like a single-stroke breakthrough to those peering in from the outside, it was anything but that to people experiencing the transformation from within. Rather, it was a quiet, deliberate process of figuring out what needed to be done to create the best future results and then simply taking those steps, one after another, turn by turn of the flywheel. After pushing on that flywheel in a consistent direction over an extended period of time, they'd hit a point of breakthrough. When we read this paragraph, we noted its applicability to our study and decided to adopt these terms in describing the good to great companies. I'd like to share with you a series of representative quotes from the interviews that illustrate this whole idea of no miracle moment in good to great. As you listen to these, let them just wash over you as you hear executives talking about what it felt like to go through the transitions. Abbott Laboratories. "It wasn't a blinding flash or a sudden revelation from above. Our change was a major change, and yet, in many respects, simply a series of incremental changes. This is what made the change successful. We did this in a nice, stepwise way. And there was always a lot of common denominators between what we had already mastered and what we were embarking on." Circuit City. "The transition to focus on the superstore didn't happen overnight. We first considered the concept in 1974, but we didn't convert fully to Circuit City superstores until about 10 years later, after we'd refined the concept and built enough momentum to bet our whole future on it." Fannie Mae. "There was no one magical event, no one turning point. It was a combination of things, more of an evolution, though the end results were dramatic." Gillette. "We didn't really make a big conscious decision or launch a big program to initiate a major change or transition. Individually and collectively, we were coming to conclusions about what we could do to dramatically improve our performance." Kimberly-Clark. "I don't think it was done as bluntly as it sounds. These things don't happen overnight. They grow. The ideas grow and mushroom and come into being." Kroger. "It wasn't a flash from the blue. We all had been watching experimental superstars develop and we were pretty well persuaded that the industry would go that way. The major thing that Lyle Everingham did was to say that we're going to change beginning now on a very deliberate basis. Nucor, we did not make a decision that this was what we stood for at any specific moment. It evolved through many agonizing arguments and fights. I am not sure that we knew exactly what we were fighting for until we looked back and said that we were fighting to establish who we were going to be. Philip Morris. It's impossible to think of one big thing that would exemplify a shift from good to great because our success was evolutionary as opposed to revolutionary, building success upon success. I don't know that there was any single event. Pitney Bowes. We didn't talk so much of change. We recognized early on not so much that we needed to change, but that we needed to evolve, which recognizes that we've got to do things differently. We realized that evolution is a whole different concept than change. Walgreens. There was no seminal meeting or epiphany moment. No one big bright light that came on like a light bulb. It was sort of an evolution thing. Wells Fargo. It wasn't a single switch that was thrown at one time. Little by little, the themes became more apparent and stronger. When Carl became CEO, there wasn't any great wrenching. Dick led one stage of the evolution, and Carl the next. And it just proceeded smoothly, rather than an abrupt shift. When teaching this point, I sometimes use an example from outside my research that perfectly illustrates the idea. The UCLA Bruins basketball dynasty of the 1960s and early 1970s. Most basketball fans know that the Bruins won 10 NCAA championships in 12 years under the legendary coach John Wooden. But do you know how many years Wooden coached the Bruins before his first NCAA championship? 15 years. From 1948 to 1963, Wooden worked in relative obscurity before winning his first championship in 1964. Year by year, Coach Wooden built the underlying foundations, developing a recruiting system, implementing a consistent philosophy, and refining the full court press style of play. No one paid too much attention to the quiet, soft-spoken coach and his team until, wham, they hit breakthrough and systematically crushed every serious competitor for more than a decade. Like the Wooden dynasty, lasting transformations from good to great follow a general pattern of buildup followed by breakthrough. In some cases, the buildup to breakthrough stage takes a long time. In other cases, a shorter time. At Circuit City, the buildup stage lasted 9 years. At Nucor, 10 years. Whereas at Gillette, it only took 5 years. At Fannie Mae, only 3 years. And at Pitney Bowes, about 2 years. But no matter how short or long it took, every good to great transformation followed the same basic pattern, accumulating momentum turn by turn of the flywheel until buildup transformed into breakthrough. Credit for the terms buildup and breakthrough should go to David S. Landis and his book, The Wealth and Poverty of Nations. On page 200, Landis writes, "The question is really twofold. First, why and how did any country break through the crust of habit and conventional knowledge to this new mode of production? Turning to the first, I would stress build-up, the accumulation of knowledge and know-how, and breakthrough, reaching and passing thresholds. It's important to understand that following the build-up, breakthrough, flywheel model is not just a luxury of circumstance. People who say, hey, but we've got constraints that prevent us from taking this longer-term approach, they should keep in mind that the good-to-great companies followed this model no matter how dire their short-term circumstances. Deregulation in the case of Wells Fargo, looming bankruptcy in the cases of Nucor and Circuit City, potential takeover threats in the cases of Gillette and Kroger, or million-dollar-a-day losses in the case of Fannie Mae. This also applies to managing the short-term pressures of Wall Street. I just don't agree with those who say you can't build an enduring great company because Wall Street won't let you, said David Maxwell of Fannie Mae. We communicated with the analysts to educate them on what we were doing and where we were going. At first, a lot of people didn't buy into that. You just have to accept that. But once we got through the dark days, we responded by doing better every single year. After a few years, because of our actual results, we became a hot stock and never looked back. And a hot stock it was. During Maxwell's first 2 years, which were in the early 1980s, the stock lagged behind the market, but then it took off. From the end of 1984 to 2000, $1 invested in Fannie Mae multiplied 64 times, beating the general market, including the NASDAQ of the late 1990s, by nearly 6 times. The good to great companies were subject to the same short-term pressures from Wall Street as the comparison companies. Yet, unlike the comparison companies, they had the patience and discipline to follow the build-up, breakthrough, flywheel model despite these pressures. And in the end, they attained extraordinary results by Wall Street's own measure of success. The key we learned is to harness the flywheel to manage these short-term pressures. One particularly elegant method for doing so came from Abbott Laboratories, using a mechanism it called the Blue Plans. Each year, Abbott would tell Wall Street analysts that it expected to grow earnings a specified amount, say 15%. At the same time, it would set an internal goal of a much higher growth rate, say 25% or even 30%. Meanwhile, it kept a rank-ordered list of proposed entrepreneurial projects that had not yet been funded, the Blue Plans. Toward the end of the year, Abbott would pick a number that exceeded analyst expectations, but that fell short of its actual growth. It would then take the difference between the make the analyst happy growth and the actual growth and channel those funds into the Blue Plans. It was a brilliant mechanism for managing short-term pressures while systematically investing in the future. We found no evidence of anything like the Blue Plans at Abbott's comparison company. Instead, executives at Upjohn would pump up the stock with a sales job, buy into our future, reverently intoning the phrase investing for the long term, especially when the company failed to deliver current results. Upjohn continually threw money after harebrained projects like Rogaine Baldness Cure, attempting to circumvent buildup and jump right to breakthrough with a big hit. Indeed, Upjohn reminded us of a gambler, putting a lot of chips on red at Las Vegas and saying, "See, we're investing in the future." Of course, when the future arrived, the promised results rarely appeared. Not surprisingly, Abbott became a consistent performer and a favorite holding on Wall Street, while Upjohn became a consistent disappointment. From 1959 to Abbott's point of breakthrough in 1974, the two stocks, Abbott and Upjohn, roughly tracked each other. Then they dramatically diverged, with Upjohn falling more than 6 times behind Abbott before being acquired in 1995. All the good to great companies effectively managed Wall Street during their build-up breakthrough years, and they saw no contradiction between the two. They simply focused on accumulating results, often practicing the time-honored discipline of under-promising and over-delivering. And as the results began to accumulate, as the flywheel built momentum turn upon turn and quarter upon quarter and year upon year, the investing community came along with great enthusiasm. The good to great companies understood a simple truth. Tremendous power exists in the fact of continued improvement and the delivery of results. Point to tangible accomplishments, however incremental at first, and show how these steps fit into the context of an overall concept that will work. When you do this in such a way that people see and feel the build-up momentum, when they can feel that flywheel starting to accumulate the turns and the clicks, they will line up with enthusiasm. We came to call this the flywheel effect, and it applies not only to outside investors, but also to internal constituents. Let me share a story from the research. At a pivotal point in the study, members of the team nearly revolted. Throwing their interview notes on the table, they asked, "Do we have to keep asking that stupid question?" "Yes." "Which stupid question?" "The one about commitment, alignment, and how they managed change." "That's not a stupid question," I replied. "It's one of the most important." "Well," said a team member, "a lot of the executives we're interviewing from the good to great companies, well, they think it's a stupid question. Some don't even understand the question." "Yes, we need to keep asking it," I said. "We need to be consistent across the interviews. And besides, it's even more interesting that they don't understand the question. So keep probing. We've got to understand how they overcame resistance to change and got people lined up." I'd fully expected that getting everyone lined up, creating alignment, to use the jargon, would be one of the top challenges faced by executives working to turn good into great. After all, nearly every executive that I'd worked with at the laboratory had asked this question in one form or another. How do we get the boat turned? How do we get people committed to the new vision? How do we motivate people to line up? How do we get people to embrace change? Turns out to be the wrong questions. To my great surprise, we did not find the question of alignment to be a key challenge faced by the good to great leaders. To be clear, the good to great companies did get incredible commitment, did get alignment. They artfully managed change. But they never really spent much time thinking about it. It was utterly transparent to them. We learned that under the right conditions, the problems of commitment, alignment, motivation, change just melt away. They largely take care of themselves. Consider Kroger. How do you get a company of over 50,000 people, cashiers, baggers, shelf stockers, produce washers, all kinds of folk, to embrace a radical new strategy that will eventually change virtually every aspect of how the company builds and runs grocery stores? The answer? You don't. Not in one big event or program, anyway. Jim Herring, the Level 5 leader who initiated the transformation at Kroger, told us that he avoided any attempts at hoopla and motivation. Instead, he and his team began turning the flywheel, creating tangible evidence that their plans made sense. Said Herring, "We presented what we were doing in such a way that people saw our accomplishments. We tried to bring our plans to successful conclusion step by step so that the mass of people would gain confidence from the successes, not just the words." Herring understood that the way to get people lined up behind a bold new vision for the future is to turn the flywheel consistent with that vision. From 2 turns to 4, from 4 to 8, to 8 to 16, 16 to 32, 64, 100, 1,000, and so forth. And then to say, "See what we're doing? And how well it's working? Extrapolate from that, and that's where we're going." The good to great companies during their transition years tended to not publicly proclaim big goals at the outset. Rather, they began to spin the flywheel, understanding turned to action, step after step, turn after turn. And after the flywheel built up momentum, they'd look up and say, "Hey, if we just keep pushing on this thing, there's no reason we can't accomplish X." For example, Nucor began turning the flywheel in 1965, at first just trying to avoid bankruptcy. Then later, building its first steel mills, simply because it could not find a reliable supplier. Nucor people believed that they had a knack for making steel better and cheaper than anyone else, so they built 2 and then 3 additional mini-mills. They gained customers, then more customers, then more customers. Whoosh! The flywheel built momentum. Turn by turn, month by month, year by year, you could feel this thing growing. Then around 1975, it dawned on the Nucor people that if they just kept pushing on the flywheel, they could become the number one most profitable steel company in America. Explained Marvin Pullman, "I remember talking with Ken Iverson in 1975, and he said, 'Marv, I think we can become the number one steel company in the United States.' 1975, and I said to him, 'Now, Ken, when are you going to be number one?' 'I don't know,' he said. But if we just keep doing what we're doing, there's no reason why we can't become number one. It took over 2 decades. But Nucor kept pushing the flywheel, eventually generating greater profits than any other steel company on the Fortune 1000 list. When you let the flywheel